Good afternoon. I'm William English, and you're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the web. Male porcupines use their urine to soften the female's quills before mating, while vultures urinate on their legs to cool themselves.
Yes, that reminds me of a story from my student days when I organised a long day of performance art, and we invited, among others, the Kipper Kids and this character Ian Hinchcliffe. And they basically performed all day long and carrying on into a party in the evening. And they were the kind of people who never really went off duty. And during the party, Ian Hinchcliffe stood there with had an empty pint beer glass in his hand, standing next to Brian Kipper, one of the Kipper Kids, who then pulled out took the pint glass from Ian Hinchcliffe, pulled out his prick, urinated in it into the glass, filled it up, gave it back to Ian Hinchcliffe, who then drank it down in one.
Today sees a welcome return to Nicky Hamlin. That's Professor Nicky Hamlin, studied fine art at Reading University and has made over 40 films, videos and installations since then. His films have been shown at festivals and screenings around the world, and his book Film Art Phenomena was published by the BFI in 2003. His recent work has been concerned with exploring and trying to refine the relationship between the camera and its pro-filmic. Nicky was last on the programme on June the 12th, a few days before a screening at Wilton's Music Hall. Between films, you gave a 30-minute talk, which made some sort of enigmatic comparisons between filming straight lines and bushes. This became quite thought-provoking and perhaps slightly teasing, I think. Was that the case?
Yeah, partly teasing, because I hadn't precisely formulated this idea myself, but it just seemed to me that when you're filming a room, there's a sense in which you're looking at a space which seems to be able to be interpreted, in a sense determined. One can look at an image of a room and think, oh yeah, that's that, and that's there, and those angles are such, and that's one aspect of it. And the other aspect is a more formal aspect to do with the interplay between the rectilinear film frame itself and the rectilinear character of a room. And I was trying to contrast that to the idea of filming a bush, where, well, the point about filming a room is that rooms turn out not to be what they initially appeared to be, or at least one can problematise that apparently decipherable perception and complicate it and show it to be not as straightforward. But one's ability to do that is based on a kind of a gap between what one thinks one's looking at and what actually is one is looking at. Whereas with a bush, say, or a hedge, if you're filming something like that, or plants, there's a sense in which if you move the plant round or if you change the framing, that you don't get that kind of tension between the thing that's being filmed and the way it's being filmed, or at least not in the same way. And I suppose that was what I was trying to get at, that there was something to do, because the talk was about room films.
Mm. So the whole programme was ostensibly about room films,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Yes.
And it included a sort of a performance of yours in which you processed film in the presence of the audience, which was actually footage of the room in which we were situated.
Yes.
So it was about the cinema space itself, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah. A kind of sight-conditioned event which placed representations of the space within the space that was represented. So, yeah.
Mm. Okay. I mean, I thought it was a very successful evening, actually. It was quite well attended, wasn't it?
It was very well attended.
Yes.
Remarkably.
Yeah, yeah.
Remarkably well attended.
I find that audiences are kind of... you think that audiences are more tolerant these days than they were to kind of rigorous films?
Oh, yeah. I suppose there are more and more art school graduates nowadays, and there's more and more film. Film and video are so pervasive now in galleries and everywhere really.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there was a conference last year or the year before called Pervasive Animation, which was addressing that kind of idea. So I suppose there are a lot more people who've become accustomed. It's just worked its way into the culture and have become accustomed to watching films and videos which might be a bit more hard going, yeah. Possibly.
Because in the past, it wasn't such a rare occurrence for possibly half the audience to leave during such
yeah,
a
yeah, and for the audience to only consist of maybe 12 people to start
absolutely,
with.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if one goes back to the days of the Filmmakers Co-op, and I can remember something like a Paul Sharitz retrospective, which James Mackay programmed, and Paul Sharitz there's recently been a lot of renewed interest in Paul Sharitz's work as kind of a proto-installation or that kind of idea, multi-projection. On a number of those screenings, there were literally only about six people in the audience. No, it's extraordinary how there is definitely a lot of new interest, new generation of people interested in that kind of work. And you know, I looked at the list actually of people who'd signed up to attend, and they were pretty overwhelmingly people I'd not heard of before. They weren't just friends and cronies. It was definitely.
The last time we touched. We touched briefly on your time at Reading in the 1970s, and then as we ran out of time, we sort of hurtled through the decades, devoting at least 30 seconds to the LFMC, Undercut magazine, and writing for Art Monthly, which by some happy coincidence you've actually got with you. You've got the latest issue of Art Monthly, haven't you?
I have,
which,
yeah.
Which you've just picked up, literally, half an hour ago?
Yeah.
And which seems to be much of it is devoted to film.
It is. It's pretty much a special issue. This is the July-August issue of Art Monthly, and it's almost, I don't know about exclusively film, but there's certainly a lot of film in there.
Yeah. I mean, we sort of glanced when we were having coffee a few minutes ago. We kind of glanced at the opening sentence and. Who is this? It's by somebody...
Colin Perry, yes. Yeah. He says, clattering and whirring film projectors are once more in vogue within contemporary moving image practice.
Can we take issue with that? Or?
Yeah, I'm not sure what he means by in vogue once more, unless he's referring back to the kind of film co-op stuff. But that was...
This has sort of been ongoing over the last 10 years, hasn't it, really?
Yes,
I mean,
it has.
With people like Tacita Dean and... Rodney Graham, whoever. I mean, wherever you go, almost, I would think over the last 10 years there's been a clattering projector somewhere.
There has. It never really went away. That's one, you're right, that's one thing. But I think the other thing is that, I'm not sure what he means by once more in vogue. What's he referring back to? You know, what's the initial instantiation of that? I don't really understand.
No.
And he says the filmic medium has an archaic death grip on artists' practices. Well, I'm not sure what that means either, unless he means he's referring to the fact that it's a dying medium. Well, it's yet to die. People have been talking about the death of film for at least 20 years, at least 20 years. And I'm always, when people mention this to me, I always like to quote, it's a little bit out of date now, but about 3 or 4 years ago I asked Len Thornton, who works at Soho Film Lab, which is the lab that all artists that work with film pretty much exclusively use, how much film do you process? And he said, well, now about a million feet of 16mm colour negative every month, which is something like 40,000 hours, which is more than they were doing 20 years ago.
Wow.
But he did say that 98% of that footage is then digitised. Uh-huh. So it doesn't stay in the form of film, it gets digitised and put onto video, which is not surprising because most of the work they do is commercial work, and that's going to be either broadcast TV or for the internet or for, it'll have commercial outcomes. But the other 2% is artists and, I don't know, other people that want to edit and project on film.
Mm.
So even 2% of a million feet is still quite a lot. So, that's the statistic that I always throw back at people. So I don't know whether...
But is it the case that certainly up until very recently, that there is more sort of information per square inch on film than there is yet on digital video? But are we getting to the point where that is no longer going to be the case?
Well, that... I think the thing is that digital video is catching up in terms of information levels, but it still looks, to me, high definition still looks completely different from film. I think you can see, if you see a high def image, it looks very different from a DV cam image, which was the previous so-called broadcast standard, or the previous kind of cutting edge standard, or digibeta actually, I suppose. But high definition, if you look at it, it's recognizably high definition video, and it doesn't really look like film. And the other thing to say is that Kodak, it's not as if once video was invented, the film manufacturers, it is mostly Kodak, but also Fuji, kind of gave up, threw in the towel. You know, they've continued to refine the film emulsions that they produce, and so now you can get 500 ASA colour negatives, which are incredibly fine grain and resolve an image. I mean, modern 16mm is probably as good as 35mm was 20 years ago, something like that, even though the frame area is only about a quarter of 35. So film has gone on developing alongside video, and so in that sense...
So you don't see it expiring within the foreseeable future anyway?
Not for a while, no. I mean, I don't really know, because... I mean, people who shoot dramas and wildlife films still seem to shoot them on film, and so I suppose as long as they think that there are advantages to doing, then it will continue. But I, at the end of the day, it's a commercial medium, and I guess that Soho Images probably don't make much profit out of the stuff that they do for artists, but they can afford to cross subsidise it from all their other activities, which includes, you know, mass producing feature films, Hollywood feature films, and stuff like that.
Yeah. Well. Anyway. As we were flying across through the decades, I was going to say, let's fly over it all again and touch down at Jackson's Lane, where I saw your films probably in the 70s, actually. Might have been 80s, I can't remember now, actually. Your films were screened alongside some by Will Milne. You were screened together quite often, I think, at that time. It was an interesting pairing and felt sort of significant at the time, I thought. The films felt very English and very much of that time. I mean, they were very sort of part of the zeitgeist. I mean, do you remember that screening? I think it was all organised by Richard Philpott.
I certainly remember that kind of an affinity between my work and Will Milne's, and there was also somebody called Deborah Loewensberg. She'd changed her name. And she was also making similar kind of work. Quite a lot of the work involved seemed to have been shot in bathrooms.
Oh, right.
And involving a certain amount of nudity, domestic space, but also kinds of room films, I suppose, if one wants to bring that back again. I suppose there was a kind of... It even got written about at the time as a kind of imagist tendency.
Right.
Because there was also Michael Mazier making work not a million miles... away from that. I'm not sure why that happened, really. I suppose I went through a period where I was making work that was a bit more autobiographical, but then I, at a certain point, I just found that it was just getting rather loose, and I just felt structurally it wasn't really... I wanted things to be tighter, and I couldn't really find a way of doing that with what I was working with. And the films were getting longer and in a way less disciplined, and I... it wasn't until I made something that was 1 minute long that I realised that I'd been...
Was that for the telly, the 1 minute films TV, for TV?
Yeah. I think the autobiographical thing partly came about through... It was an effect or an influence of who I'd been taught by. Because I'd been taught by people like Malcolm LeGrice and Ron Hazelden, who was making quite structural films at the time. But also people like Mark Shumovitz and Stuart Brisley, who were more interested in kind of autobiographical, personal kind of work. So I suppose those films that I was making then, and also Will Milne's work, reflected that. Although he was actually at the Royal College at the same time as Peter Goodall, so one could see his work perhaps as a reaction against some of the things that were being taught at the Royal College, possibly.
Yeah.
Because his films were very kind of lyrical. Wonderful films, actually.
Will Milne's? Yes, I mean, yeah, he sort of made films for about 10 years, and then I think he just gave up film altogether.
He stopped and became a cabinet maker, really. I think he was just finding it very difficult to make films and make a living at some time.
Certainly, those sorts of films, yeah.
Yeah.
Can't have been much return for them.
No.
But then in 1987, you made a film called Uncertainty, silent colour, 24 minutes, which... takes the form of three separate films, all silent, and include footage of the Tottenham riots, shot in various degrees of close-up. How do you feel about that film now? It was a more overtly political film in that it contained political imagery, which perhaps you didn't actually carry on with that. You sort of went back to sort of making room films.
Yeah, I never show that film. I made a couple of films like that. I also made one in the late 70s, a similar one. Because I think when I was, well, in the first case, I made a film called Inside Out, where when I was a student, I'd really been exposed to a lot of structural film, so-called structural film, and landscape, experimental landscape film, and William Raeburn, that kind of stuff. And we were, as students, we always kind of used to have arguments about, are we just being self-indulgent and bourgeois and locked up in our little ivory tower, which is a bit what Reading felt like with its quadrangle and its cloisters and everything. So there'd always be these arguments going on, and so I made this kind of sexual politics film, which was an attempt to kind of at least acknowledge that there's this other stuff going on when there was a lot of, in the 70s, was a lot of kind of left-wing Trotskyite stuff going on, and also feminist activity. And then the uncertainty was another kind of, yeah, it was an attempt to make a kind of political film which had political content. But even as I was making, I was thinking, I'm trying to put theory first, and actually it's quite an incoherent film, although there are chunks of it which work quite well in other respects. But when I think back about that film,
I suppose it's interesting visually, because I presume you used an optical printer to rework, so that the footage of the police lines
TV
and
footage.
Fires becomes quite rhythmical and abstract, but without ever losing sight of the fact that what you're seeing is a riot. I mean, there's no getting away from that. But it becomes quite beautiful in a way, a bit like Tom Tom the Piper's Son by Ken Jacobs, which kind of, you know, tries to go through every permutation of and every detail of the footage you're looking at.
It makes it sound very problematic, doesn't it, now? And I think, you know, the idea of aestheticizing or turning, making something aesthetic out of something that is kind of political, or it's TV footage of riots. I'm not sure what I think about that now. I thought at the time I was somehow sort of analysing the footage and doing something with it. And there was a sense in which it was all filmed from the police side, footage,
really?
And so there was it had a particular kind of. There was a particular setup there, but I'm not sure that my reworking of that.
It's probably quite sensible in a way, to be.
Yes, yeah.
You want to be
on the other side.
But yes, anyway, that's another issue.
As a film, it doesn't really hang together, and it also had some footage of my then young son and some other stuff of a bus stop, which the whole section which works quite well as an individual piece, but doesn't really make sense in the context of the other stuff. And I think, like I said before, I think the mistake I made was trying to get some kind of content, as it were, into the work, you know, and you can't really do it like that. You have to work in a more organic way.
But if you kind of override that, doesn't one just end up basically dwelling on sort of interior spaces and so on, unless there is room somewhere to introduce footage or imagery which can relate to otherwise it's always about representation, isn't it?
I think that is a perpetual issue. But on the other hand, you know, there is a kind of politics of perception, a politics of form, which I think that the work can construct or create a relationship with the viewer, where the viewer is somehow trying to, is somehow required to wrestle with what's on the screen, rather than simply to.
Right.
I mean, I know this is kind of an old argument, and you know, about do you just sit and consume the stuff, or do you actually try and grapple with it? And in a way, you know, with paintings, with complex paintings like, say, a Cézanne still life, you know, if you really want to get into that picture and really see what's happening, you have to kind of really look and spend some time and grapple with it. And in a way, film should be able to do something like that as well. And I think that one can achieve that, or one can work towards that through the way that the material is structured. So it's not necessarily about what the images are actually of, you know, you could have depoliticized films of political activity and vice versa, I think.
Right.
I mean, the Art Monthly piece where he talks about the Colin Perry piece where he's talking about watching structural materialist film he's referring to an event with Peter Goodall at Chisenhale Gallery where one of his films, Volcano, Denials, was shown. And he's criticising it in a way. This is leading on from what we were just talking about. He says, so what must one think about... he says, one can be bored on a bus, train or plane, but the difference in being bored in a cinema is that one is expected to muse like a Frankfurtian intellectual, rather than, say, think of ordinary distractions like sex, sea shanties or South Park. So what must one think about when viewing a structural materialist film? Very little, it seems, except perhaps the modernist reductio ad absurdum. I'm watching a film that has been filmed on film and is being projected by a projector. But you see, I think that the reductio absurdum is Colin Perry's rather than the structural film project. I don't think the structural film project was ever reductive in that way. And I was thinking about this on the way here, that the George Landau film, which is called Film in Which Sprocket Holes, Dirt Particles, etc., Splices Appear, to me that's a polemical title for a film. It describes what the film is, but it doesn't capture the complexity of the experience of watching the film, which is also about time, repetition, light, colour.
In the case of that film, isn't it people in a boat? It's like a boating lake approaching don't they come towards you? It's almost like in a sort of Disneyland type situation or am I mixing it up with someone else? Or is this the one about the test card?
Yeah, the test
card. Oh, it's the test card.
It's the test card that you see at the beginning on Leader. You have those three frames of a woman's face with makeup on, which they use for... That's a kind of... it's rather like the colour bars on videos used for grading, the colour grading, getting it right for the film.
Oh, yes. But presumably the imagery, I suppose, in that case is so banal that actually you almost can't engage with it because there is nothing there... almost nothing there to engage with.
And so you're kind of forced on to say, well, what else is here? In a way, what else is there to look at?
Yeah.
But it also makes you... I mean, this is the idea, that it would also make you think, well, where's my place in this? You know, where am I? How do I relate to this? And how... what's the experience for me? And there is an experience of kind of repetition and duration. If you want to have that experience... the point I was simply trying to make was that this reduction to the material substrate or whatever it is that people like writers like Peter Wallen always went on about, I think is a misrepresentation of what structural film aimed to be, which I don't think structural filmmakers ever said that their film was about the material substrate. It was always much more, because film is much more complex by nature. You can't boil it down to a single thing. It's not just the film strip. It's not just the projection event or the projector or the camera. It's a complex of things. And time and repetition, things are always going to be involved in duration, rhythm. So, in a way, I think he's it's just a mischaracterization, really. Anyway.
Right. But we are... I think we've got to mention this Douglas Gordon film, haven't we?
Absolutely.
Before we get to the end.
Yeah.
We've got to... Okay, get the knives out. Sharpen your knives here. Okay. Well, Douglas Gordon made a film called Zidane. Which amazingly, got cinema release. For those who haven't seen it, the film closely follows a single footballer, Zinedine Zidane, on the pitch. So even though there's a football match going on with 22 people and a vast audience, basically the camera focuses for the entire film just on one person, even when he's not doing very much. But the point is that there is an alarming similarity with a film made in 1970 by Helmut Kostard called Football as Never Before, which focuses exclusively on George Best for 90 minutes. Is it conceivable that Gordon was unaware of the Kostard film? Has he reinvented it unconsciously? Or
I think he must have seen it just as the former editor of the News of the World must have known that his journalists were up to no good, you know. How could he not have done?
Subliminal editing or something.
But the Kostard film is so much better. I mean, the Zidane film is very conventional. It sets up this very kind of conventional adulatory kind of a lot of close-ups of him. And it's as far as possible, given the nature of the subject matter, it's structured very conventionally in that sense. I think it creates a very conventional kind of relationship with its audience. Whereas the Helmut Kostard film is much more consistent, and it's quite cool and distanced. The other thing to say about the Zidane film, it has a music track, whereas the Costard film, there are little moments of music, but mostly it's sync sound that comes with the film. So there's an interesting interplay between off-screen sound and on-screen, where you're looking at George Best, who a lot of the time isn't doing anything, and the framing is much more consistent. There are fewer cuts, there are longer takes, and also he has a long shot of George Best, a portrait where George Best stands for the camera for about 2 minutes at the beginning. So it's for me, I found it a much more interesting film because it was more rigorous. It was much more. Its strategy was much more consistent and more rigorous. I felt the Zidane film was really very conventional, and maybe that's why it was popular, because in a way it sort of gives people what they want. And
All right. well, I think we could. You brought in a CD for us, haven't you? This is. Tell me about this. This is from a magazine called Inside Out. Curated by Andrew Cotting, and tell me about it.
Well, it's the Sonic Arts Network do these three a year. They issue a CD and they invite someone to curate each time. Because Andrew Cotting teaches on the same course as me at Maidstone, he asked various people, including myself, would we like to contribute something on this theme of Inside Out? Inscape.
Uh-huh.
And so I made a short piece for it, which it's the only kind of sound work I've ever made, actually.
Is it?
Yeah.
Only independent sound work, as it were.
Yeah. I mean,
you've made some of your films have got
some of them have got soundtracks, but most of them are silent.
So there's 22 contributors to this Inside Out, and yours is called Brown 4729 Stereo.
Yeah.
Which.
That refers to the. It's an electronic toothbrush, and that refers to the model number of the electronic toothbrush.
Well, I think we can probably play out with this. Well, thank you very much, Nicky, for coming in again.
Well, thank you.
And here we're going to play out with Nicky's track, Brown 4729 Stereo.